You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Send in your nominations now for the APN Awards. The APN Awards celebrate the best in archaeology, heritage, history, anthropology, museum, and cultural podcasts from around the world. Open to independent, academic, institutional, and network-produced shows, the awards recognize outstanding storytelling, research communication, production, hosting, and more. Award categories include Podcast of the Year, Best Educational Podcast, Best New Podcast, Best Interview, Best Storytelling Episode, Best Host, and several fun APN-only awards for those shows hosted on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Send in your nominations before the 1st of August 2026. Public voting will then be open from the 1st of September to the 1st of October 2026, and then will culminate in a live awards show on the International Day of Archaeology, so October 17th, 2026. Find out all information and send in your nominations through the Archaeology Podcast Network website.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Well, welcome back, all you interested professionals and lay people, to the Rock Art Podcast episode 169 on the Archaeology Podcast Network. We have an extraordinary episode for you, working with a gentleman who's been working for decades on one of the most controversial and interesting and remarkable archaeological sites in the entire world. His name is Jens Notruff. He's with the German Archaeological Institute. Jens, welcome.
Hello, and thanks for having me on the show.
It's really a pleasure. And you're hailing from Germany, are you not?
I am. It's pretty dark outside here already right now.
Yes. So it's been a challenge connecting, but here you are, and it's really a blessing to, and an honor to have you. Why don't you share, if you could, with our listener, the journey that you've had and the niche that you currently hold with respect to your archaeological scholarship?
Yeah, for sure. But first of all, thanks for having me on the show, for inviting me. It's my pleasure to discuss our work and research in this context of rock art, because I think there's a quite interesting connection in terms of imagery, iconography, but we can come back to this later, I guess. My name is Jens Notruff. I'm an archaeologist, a prehistorian from Germany. I'm living in Berlin, and I am working at the German Archaeological Institute, and this is where I got in touch with the Göbekli Tepe excavations as well. I started pretty early in terms of my own career with the project. I joined Klaus Schmidt, the then excavator of Göbekli Tepe, back then in 2005 or 6, I think. Still a student then, and I joined as a student assistant. And somehow I stuck with the project, and I later worked for them as a research assistant and an assistant to the head of excavations. And I'm still working at the German Archaeological Institute, not directly in the Göbekli Tepe research project anymore. I switched positions a couple of years ago, and I'm now the desk officer for science communication at the institute. That means I'm responsible for communicating not only my own work and research, as I used to do already in the Göbekli Tepe excavations as well, but now for the whole institute. And this is quite a challenging but also fun task, as you probably can imagine.
Tell us a bit more about the institute and the subject, the particular research themes that they're going for, the sites, mm-hmm. etc., geography, etc.
Yeah, the German Archaeological Institute is quite an old institution, actually. In 2029, we're having our 200th anniversary, and it was founded back then in Rome in 1829.
Oh, my word.
Pretty much like a correspondence club or writing club by wealthy scholars and artists. They just wanted to exchange about the still very young discipline of archaeology back then, mostly classical archaeology, so Roman and Greek stuff, and particular Roman stuff, because it was founded in Rome. And pretty early on, they got affiliated with the Prussian Foreign Office. And that is the reason why we're still part of the German Foreign Office as of today. So we are the National German Archaeological Research Institution, and we are politically affiliated, and we are pretty much doing research all over the world on almost every continent, well, except Antarctica, where there's not that much archaeology to research in Antarctica. But we're working all over the world in international corporations, and I dare to say the German Archaeological Institute is one of the top research institutions in the world in terms of archaeology.
I'm sure. So you've been with Göbekli Tepe for quite a while. How did it evolve? How did you know what you're getting into? I'm sure you didn't initially. And then it becomes such a stellar and central subject that is of greatest merit and interest to archaeologists and the general public all around the world. Please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a story on its own. As I said, I started pretty early on in 2005. So excavations are, or the excavation project itself, is pretty young compared to other large-scale excavations. The site was rediscovered in 1994 and excavations started in 1995. So when I joined the excavations, it was all pretty new in terms of when work started. And it's quite interesting to see how the site and the region developed, not only in the public perception, but the physical site itself. I mean, no offense to the region, but it, from my point of view as a young student, it was in the middle of nowhere. It was at the Turkish-Syrian border, so very far away in the mountains, very dry and a rock plateau. Not really the kind of spot where you imagine to spend your holiday.
And is it somewhat anomalous in terms of its geographical location, in terms of resources or geography, etc.?
We thought so. It was quite an erratic place because it was in the mountain, not exactly a favorable settlement situation. But thanks to really extended research by now, Göbekli Tepe is by far not the only site with this cultural phenomenon. In the last 10 years, a couple of more sites were under excavation, now showing that indeed this is not the sensational single exceptional find, but part of an archaeological cultural phenomenon in the region.
Part of a larger pattern, correct?
Definitely.
Now, when did you finally discern the antiquity of the site? Because that's, of course, was a huge surprise.
Yeah, I mean, just to get the audience into the picture, we're talking about the pre-pottery Neolithic here, and that means we're talking about the period 12,000 years ago from today. So it's the 10th millennium BC, and we're talking about monumental architecture, 5.5 meter high stone pillars erected in circles. So that is quite spectacular. But we're also talking about a culture which is still highly mobile, but actually at the threshold to settled and sedentary society. This is the region and the time where our own, today's own way of living was set up, so to say. So this is the way where mobile hunter-gatherers turned or became sedentary food producers with agriculture and husbandry. And that makes it so, so spectacular.
But at this point, the characterization of the site is definitely pre-agricultural, hunter-gatherer, and no evidence for any sort of domestication of plants or animals, etc.
Yeah. We can be pretty sure about that because we found numerous animal bones and also a lot of plant remains. And every single species so far detected in the filling of the site is wild species only. So there's no hint at any domesticated animals or plants. I mean, this is easy to say, but in reality, domestication takes quite some time.
Sure.
You will need generations, for example, to really see that an animal changed so far that is recognizable as a domesticated animal. So maybe we can already talk about management, animal management, but definitely it's all wild species we still have on the site.
So did you have any inkling that the site was as old as it was determined? Was there any sort of intuition or were you surprised?
Well, it was not that much of a surprise because the surface of the site already back then, actually pretty much earlier already, there was an archaeological survey in the 1960s. It was a joint survey from the universities of Chicago and Istanbul, as far as I recollect. And already when they noted that the whole site was littered with flint artifacts.
Okay.
So pretty early on, it was clear, okay, this is a Neolithic site. how old it actually is became clear when the typical flint, arrowhead, projectile points and so on were typologically examined. And then it became clear, okay, this is something belonging to the pre-pottery Neolithic. So the age was not really the surprise, but the monumental architecture discovered there, that was the actual surprise.
That was the real surprise. So when you found these flint artifacts, there were chronologically diagnostic artifact types that discerned immediately what you were looking at as to the time, the age of the site.
Yeah, without the questions, the tool types already gave it away. But then, in the course of excavation, of course, we obtained much more material, which we were also able to date methods. For example, the wall plasters we found in these buildings containing pieces of charcoal, which could be radiocarbon dated. And these dates actually confirmed the archaeological dating already.
And Göbekli Tepe is one of the older sites of this pattern, correct?
Meanwhile, yes, with all the other sites excavated, it's pretty much in the middle, I would say.
In the middle. So okay.
There are a couple older sites, there are a couple younger sites, but I mean, it's difficult to get an order here because these sites were used over quite some time and there was a lot of renovation, reparation, and building activity going on over this long time. So it's hard to get some kind of a chronological hierarchy here, but it's pretty much in the pattern. Yeah.
In the middle.
Yeah.
So the big surprise, the aha, was to see this monumental architecture. Is those T-shaped pillars, those monumental architecture, are they found at other sites in the region?
Mm-hmm. To be honest, Göbekli Tepe was not even the first site where these T-shaped pillars were discovered. Okay. In the 80s, during the construction of the Atatürk Dam Reservoir, a lot of rescue archaeology was going on in the region. And a colleague from the German Archaeological Institute in Istanbul,
yes,
stumbling upon a site by accident, actually, where we're looking for something completely different, but we're stumbling upon the site of Nivelli Chori. And this is turned out also a Neolithic site, a bit younger than Göbekli Tepe. But here, for the first time, these T-shaped pillars were discovered in one special communal building. So it was one building with these pillars, and they were significantly smaller than at Göbekli Tepe, but they already provided this T-shape. And
yes,
it was the experience from Nivelli Chori which actually helped Klaus Schmidt to recognize the importance of Göbekli Tepe. I told you that in the 1960s there already was the survey, but in the report, the Göbekli Tepe part is rather short and it was not deemed worthy of an immediate excavation because some of the stone fragments were considered historic cemeteries,
right,
and maybe not that much important. But Klaus Schmidt, with the experience from Nivelli Chori and the knowledge of these T-pillars, immediately recognized that these stone fragments were in fact part of these T-pillars.
So he had the context.
Yeah, that was quite an advantage he had. And we cannot blame the colleagues from the 1960s. They could not know this because it was unbeknownst to them and to everybody else by then.
Now, in the other sites, that this other site that had the T-shaped pillar, you said it was not quite as heavy, correct, or mm-hmm. as large as the ones at Göbekli?
Yeah, and this is something we can also witness at Göbekli Tepe and the other sites. There seems to be some kind of a chronological development. So the older monuments seem to be larger. At Göbekli Tepe, we're talking about T-shaped pillars, monolithic pillars, so like the Latin letter T, with a height of 4 to 5.5 meters. And they are getting smaller in the later phases. At Göbekli Tepe as well, there are later phases with smaller pillars with a size of up to 2 meters. So there is some kind of a chronological development here.
Now, also, was there the ornate iconography mm-hmm. found at any of the other sites?
By now it seems a bit as if each site has a very, very distinct language, so to say. So there are common themes. So you see a lot of animal decorations,
yes,
for example, a lot of
yes.
engravings of animals, of reliefs of animals. But sometimes the sites seem to have a very specific focus. And that makes it quite interesting and that tells us that these are local variations of the very same phenomenon, actually.
Now, when you say local phenomenon mm-hmm. and the differences in representation of animals, are there particular animals, they sometimes call them indexical animals,
mm-hmm.
that are primarily or more frequently represented at certain sites?
No, it's more wet. It's all a preliminary, of course.
But yes.
My impression, it seems that some of the sites seem to be more human focused and some more animal focused. But since you were asking for index animals, it's quite interesting because that is something we can already witness at Göbekli Tepe, or we think we can witness this, because we're talking about different building, different structures here with these T-shaped pillars. So they all look quite similar. There's one central pair of pretty large pillars in the middle, in the center, and they are surrounded by other pillars of this T-shape in a circle. And so you have several of these circular buildings. And interestingly, there seems to be one animal emphasized in each building. It's not that only this animal would be depicted in the building, but there seems to be a strong focus on one particular animal. So there's one circle with a lot of fox depictions, there's one circle with a lot of boar depictions, and so on. So this might be, or might not be, we have to see this, and quite an interesting take on if you're talking about totemic animals or different groups or something like that.
It could in fact be some sort of totemic.
Yeah. With all hesitation, that might be an interesting interpretation. Yeah, for sure.
No, absolutely. We got to jump, but I published a paper on exactly that particular subject.
No, fascinating.
The forager totemic, you know, there's different kinds of totems. It's increase in social totems, and the increased totems were such that they were analogous to some of the ethnographic information from Australia.
Yeah, exactly. There are quite a couple of interesting ethnographic and historic analogies.
Absolutely. And the site that I worked on seemed to be focused highly on, of course, bighorn sheep, needless to say. And so they had actual fashioning of these images that were correct. And it was a men's site exclusively also. Well, we'll cut it off there and we'll pick it up on the next one.
Okay.
Pick it up on the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is segment two for your episode 169. And we're talking with Jens Notruff about Göbekli Tepe, which is phenomenal. Jens, go right ahead. We're just continuing to talk about how to deal with the data and how to best come up with inferences and how to best understand the nature and function and specific characterization of such an important site. Go ahead, Jens.
Yeah, that's the tricky part, isn't it? I mean, excavation is all fun and games, and then you have to make sense of the data collected.
Yes.
And this, I think it was Klaus Schmidt who once told me, he just did the maths and he said, you know, for every month staying here at the excavation, we need at least 3 months in the office, in the library, to make sense of this stuff. And I think he was underestimating the amount of time, because what the team is doing right now is trying to process this huge amount of data collected in over 30 years of excavations. And I mean, it's a pretty young excavation, but still there's this huge amount of data. And one of the big challenges in the beginning was to understand the site itself. So how big is it actually? Does it really consist only of these communal buildings? Is there something else going on? And this is interesting because meanwhile, our understanding, our image of the site is changing due to the increase in data which was processed. So while in the beginning, it really appeared like somehow hitting kind of a ceremonial center only consisting of communal buildings, of these special purpose buildings. But now the picture looks quite different. So the latest things I heard, there seem to be much, much more residential structures, or what is can be interpreted as residential structures. And this will be quite interesting to see how the site was actually used. So that is a big challenge to understand the data. And what we were doing in the beginning to somehow get an idea of the site is after these circular enclosures were excavated in what we call the main excavation site, which only was one hollow in the southeast of the site, was to get an idea of the rest of the big mound, which was actually covering these enclosures. And therefore, we were doing geomagnetics, geophysics, to get an idea of what was going on and trying to excavate a particular spot to verify if we just hit these special buildings by luck or if they are indeed all over the place. And this is what the colleagues are trying to process right now, to get an idea if there's a settlement and how long were people living there or using these enclosures.
What is your current sort of intuition on this? You said you have residential structures
and
the ceremonial. What's the mix? mainly ceremonial or mainly residential?
Yeah.
A little bit of both?
This is, I'm not a big fan of this distinction of ceremonial and residential, because okay. This is a very modern projection into the past. I think for the people, for the Neolithic people, both could be simply be assigned to these structures. Well, there could have been the profane and the ritual could be easily connected in everyday life. So what we see right now is a much, much more complexity of activities going on there. So, I mean, people have to stay there if they are using these enclosures. So it would make sense to have residential areas. And what I've seen now is that there are a lot of cooking installations and a lot of the stuff which was missing earlier. So this is one of the pillars, so to say, forgive the pun, of the processing of the interpretation work going on right now. But the second big leg is making sense of the iconography of the site, which is very, very specific and very complex. We haven't talked much about the iconography, but this is a huge topic, actually.
So is there iconography associated with the smaller, less elaborate, less ceremonial places?
I think that's an interesting question. I think the iconography is all over the place, but in different levels of appearance, so to say. So you've got the reliefs on these huge monumental pillars, mostly depicting animals. A lot of hunted game, actually, so like a fox, aurochs, gazelle, boar, but also what we would consider nasty animals like snakes, scorpions, insects, and so on. So it's not only an inventory of the hunted fauna. But some of these images also appear, also in less frequency, on the smaller pillars. And interestingly, they also appear on mobile finds like stone vessels, like stone plaquettes, chef straighteners, for example, but also plaquettes which seem to have no other function than to bear this imagery. So there's a lot of complexity going on in the iconography as well, I would say. And it's not really related only to a part of the site or even to this site. Interestingly, we can see the very same images, the very same iconography over much, much wider region of at least 200 kilometers in the northern Fertile Crescent.
So these same images, yes, are not restricted to this one location, but they do occur in a much broader geographical pattern, correct?
Yes, yes. So even in areas, in regions where the T-pillars themselves are not present, the same images are present at least. So the same style, the same convention on how to depict aurochs, snakes, and so on are definitely present.
Do they the same general time period, a little bit earlier, a little bit later? Okay, good.
Covering the same time period. And I would say this is what we can recognize kind of in communication sphere here. This is a network, an exchange network. Over quite a large region, people were exchanging information, where maybe even traveling and communicating over such a wide area. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Absolutely. One of the things I read that I didn't understand initially that I heard was when there was originally thought that the structures did not have roofs. Mm. Or that the site itself was reburied. I know both those particular interpretations were misinterpretations or falsified, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's the deeper you dig, the more information you get.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, we were playing with all kinds of interpretations. Okay, there are these open buildings like Stonehenge, you know, Stonehenge,
right,
is although much younger, is the archetype of this monumental architecture. And indeed, I now witnessed or experienced the buildings under open sky during the excavation. And now where we are, a museum exhibition with a protective shelter. And I can tell you, these are two completely different experiences of space. So it makes sense to think about roofs here. And meanwhile, we also found some evidence for roofs. A couple of years ago, the colleagues found in the backfilling of these enclosures, they found traces, negatives of wooden boards. So it would make sense to have roofs there. And the building historical examination also meanwhile confirms this, because interestingly, there seems to be kind of a common hate of the surrounding pillars. And where this common hate is not achieved, they were putting stones on top of the pillar heads to get the same level. So there really is a lot of strong argument in favor of roofs, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. So there was at one point discussions about the archaeoastronomical significance of the iconography.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like that's going to be rather controversial. Do you have thoughts on that, Jens?
Yeah, I mean, the specific examples you're probably hinting at here are a bit problematic. First, I'm not an opponent of archaeoastronomy in general, or I think it could be a possible interpretation applied to the Göbekli Tepe structures as well. But the suggestions put forward so far are not really convincing, because they really have a major problem we are quite often confronted in interpretations put forward in terms of the site. And this is that a lot of people who come up with these quite interesting ideas are only looking at a very small example of iconography, of architecture. So the most famous archaeoastronomical interpretations in terms of a comet depiction, or that it is a warning of the Younger Dryas impact yeah. comet, is yeah. particularly difficult, because this is focusing strictly on the iconography of one singular pillar. And we have hundreds yeah. of these pillars. We have thousands of images in all these sites. And I find it quite difficult to single out one pillar. So what about all the other pillars? What are they telling us astronomically? So I have my difficulties. Yeah.
So Jens, it seems like when we're dealing with archaeological interpretation, and the cautionary note to our, you know, those that are scholars or general public are trying to understand Göbekli Tepe and the broader pattern, is drill down to the data and also look at the variability of that data.
Yeah.
And you need a representative sampling of what we see there, and to tease out the significant patterns.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
We need to consider all data we have. I mean, a big problem with a lot of these interpretations is that they have great ideas, but they have the interpretation at the beginning, and then they start collecting data to fit into this interpretation. While we have to do it the other way around. We have to put all the data on the table and have to look what is the most plausible interpretation for all of the data.
And I see that regularly with a lot of our fellow colleagues in the archaeological profession. They tend to want to have a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly.
In the sense that they have a particular explanatory platform that they're trying to support, fulfill, bolster, mm-hmm. and then the data later is then used to support it as best they can. But they aren't really spending the time and energy to look at the full picture.
And I mean, it's really a challenge here. You're working in rock art as well, so you know what I'm talking about. The problem with these images is that we only have the images. It's a prehistoric society, so we have no writing. We do not know any of the ideas behind the images. We only have the result. So the whole narrative context is missing. It's like somebody is showing you the Last Supper painting by Leonardo da Vinci, and you only see a couple of people eating because you do not know the story behind it.
Exactly. Although some of my colleagues would say, well, Jens, it's only rock art and you can say whatever you want to say. I don't agree with that. I think that there is a way of analyzing or considering this imagery and looking at the ethnographic record and then looking at all other data sets that you can muster to come up with some reasonable theories and examine them in light of the data.
Yeah, for sure.
And we can look at what I call forager theology, comparative forager theology, and then examine them in that light. We were just talking about perhaps the particular groupings having totemic significance, which would be fascinating. And I like that line of thinking.
Yeah, and I mean, what we also can see beyond the it's only rock art, we can see that these are indeed means of communication, these communication media.
Yes.
And interestingly, what we have a lot of these large animal depictions I was talking about. So we have the aurochs, for example, the distinct origin of the cattle. And interestingly, we see in the course of this whole iconography, we can see that they started to somehow simplify the complex depiction of an aurochs, of this huge monster of a cattle, to a symbol, to the buccranium, to only the head of the aurochs. So it seemed to address the same animal, but it's shortened to a symbol. And we see this with a lot of other animal depictions as well. We see snakes simplified to zigzag lines in these portable stone placards.
Exactly.
So the iconography is scaled down, but it's still narrative. It's still transporting the same information. And this is quite interesting. And this is what the analyst can tell us.
I call that a visual shorthand.
Yeah.
And the visual shorthand is something that I see, well, of course, cross-culturally, but certainly certain anatomical elements of those animals tend to be most sacred, most powerful, most holy, and those that are ceremonially focused, such as the heads, as an example.
Exactly. And interestingly, we have, I told you, we have a lot of animal bones in, the,
yes,
in this site.
Yes. So,
in particular, aurochs bones, hinting at huge amounts of meat consumed there. But interestingly, the heads are missing. So there are no aurochs heads in the whole site. They are found in the settlements, which would make sense because the meat was brought up to the site and you do not eat the heads. So you only bring the stuff you were eating. But it's interesting to note that the heads are, we find the heads in the settlements, in installations, and they are on display there. It's quite an interesting, I think, an interesting connection to the iconography there as well.
Right. And the heads are normally handled differently, at least a comparative theology, in that those were considered to be sort of the sources of power, the sources of, you know, religious holiness. And those often have to be disposed of or dealt with completely differently, right?
Yeah, and this is, now that you mention it, this is also something we can witness with the human depictions on site as well.
Please.
I mean, the T-shaped pillars, I didn't mention it, but the huge T-shapes are actually anthropomorphic sculptures, where human-like sculptures. The T is more or less the abstract depiction of a human silhouette and inside view.
Yes.
We have depictions of arms and hands, we have a loincloth and belts. So it's pretty clear that these are meant, well, at least human. I'm not sure if it's humans. I'm careful to not call them gods, because we do not have any evidence for that, but they're 5.5 meters high, so a pretty huge human depictions. And on the other hand, we have life-sized and very naturalistic sculptures of human beings. And this is interesting because, again, on the site, we barely have the whole full sculptures, but mostly the heads of these sculptures, broken off heads, which are there in the filling. So it's just quite an interesting connection to what you just said about the specific meaning of the head of the skull.
Well, let's stop it there. We'll pick it up on the next segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is episode 169. This is your third segment, final segment with Jens Nordtroff about Göbekli Tepe, which is one of the more interesting and remarkable discoveries in the archaeological world. It's been had a lot of ink and electronic digital narrative spilled throughout time. Jens, so what's the takeaway from your efforts to date? What should the academic and the public know about your efforts that to make a difference, and why does it matter? Please.
That's quite an interesting question. I was thinking about this myself. I mean, the most obvious thing is that there is something like a huge archaeological culture producing monumentality 12,000 years ago, and we only knew about this since, 30 years? So a rather young phenomenon. That definitely tells us it's still worth to keep looking, to keep digging, because there still is so much to discover about the past. But personally, what I find most interesting about not only the site of Göbekli Tepe, but now with these other excavations in the region as well, is that what started as a sensation about earliest monumentality, and this is definitely what people are grasping at and what people find fascinating, and what this is what makes the, well, made the site so famous and so interesting. But working on the fundament below these monuments, this is what the social fundament, so to say, is what I find more interesting in the meantime, actually. So the monuments and the buildings are quite fascinating, but thinking about the people who built these monuments is even more exciting, in my opinion, because imagine these huge buildings of pillars, each weighing tons, and they have to be carried over there, they have to be carved, they have to be erected. And this is definitely something which is exceeding the manpower of a single hunter-gatherer band. So it speaks for a cooperation, for communal effort. There are groups coming together at these sites, building these monuments together. And this is what I find quite interesting, because bringing so many people together means that you need to somehow organize and coordinate this effort. This is something we did not talk enough about in the past, I think, in terms of these early hunter-gatherer communities. So how did they organize themselves? How did they organize the work? Is this something like an emerging hierarchy, social hierarchy? Or is this something emerging in itself? So there's work to do and somehow groups are forming to get it done? Or are there certain individuals somehow rising in power? So where did it start and where did it go actually? This is what I find even more interesting than the physical monumentality itself.
Yeah, so of course, what we're saying here, Jens, is that what's the correlates for the archaeological record? What does it say about the people,
exactly.
about their prehistoric lifeways, about their cosmology, their religion, and also the organization, their socio-political organization, their kinship systems?
Yeah, the how and when, the how and why. So why did they do it and how did they do it? I mean, it's pretty cheap, but we all know that archaeology is not about the objects, but the objects are only the media for us to get to the people. We are interested in the people of the past. And this is something which maybe we are not often enough communicating in a more public context, that we are, well, the objects are great, but actually it's the people we are interested in.
We want the flesh and bones that pull together. The skeletons that we find the tatters and the refuse, but it does tell us something compelling about the people, does it not?
It does. It definitely does tell us about the people. And something I find always very touching, I do a lot of public work. There's a huge exhibition in Berlin right now, the finds from Göbekli Tepe and the other sites. And I did quite some public talks, some guided tours through the exhibition with a lot of different groups. And something which is quite touching and interesting to me is that in the end of these tours, a lot of these groups are keen and interested in asking, what happened to these people? Where are we now? What happened to the people building these huge monuments?
Sure.
And the easy answer always is, well, they did not vanish. They became us. Actually, we are these people because...
We're the descendants.
Yeah, exactly. Even literally, because the people from Anatolia were moving northwards and into Central Europe. So we probably are literally these people.
Have you found any human remains?
There are human remains more on the other side. As far as I know, there seem to be some recent find of skeletal material. But in general, Göbekli Tepe, interestingly, in the past at least, did not produce very much human remains. A couple of bones, skull fragments, if I recollect correctly. This is quite interesting. But maybe this has to do with one of the purposes of the site we were also thinking about, because something which is noteworthy among the iconography, not only at Göbekli Tepe, but in particular at Göbekli Tepe, is that we have a lot of depictions of vultures in context with human bodies, with headless human bodies, separated human heads. In relief and sculptures, there's a lot of birds crouching on human heads or headless human bodies in connection to vultures. And this is something which had us thinking about mortuary ritual.
Exactly.
In particular, sky burials, where you somehow have let necrophagous animals like vultures help in excarnation of the human bodies. And this goes well with another phenomenon in the region. And this is that there seems to be a very strong curiosity about the articulation of the human body. So we have a lot of painted bones, we have remodeled skulls, we have displayed skulls. I mean, Jericho are the most famous example, with these remodeled skulls. So, but to do something like this, you need excavated bones. And maybe Göbekli Tepe also served in terms of such a excavation site where bodies, the corpses, were presented to these necrophagous animals.
Yeah, to the sky.
Yeah.
What do we know about linguistic prehistory and the ethnicity of the people that would have lived that long ago?
Not that much. I mean, genetically, we can track them. We can follow them, actually, to Northern Central Europe, or to Central Europe in particular, to the British Isles at least. But linguistically, it's difficult because we do not have much historic sources telling us about this. But I think the iconography goes on for quite a long time, even until Çatalhöyük, which is also a pretty famous Neolithic site, one of the first towns in quotation marks, significantly later, but with a very similar iconography.
Well, there you go. There you go. Do we have more evidence in a more recent fashion of what the ethnolinguistic affiliation and the language and the culture might be?
Well, not that I'm aware of. There are bits and pieces which seem to shine through in patterns on modern ethnographic art, but I think that would be quite far-fetched to draw lines here.
And there's no genetics that goes back that far.
Not yet. I'm having high hopes on these other sites on excavation now, once they produce more material. But the sad truth is that the bone preservation is not really good. And in particular, the appetite, which you would need for dating, and the DNA is, as of yet, does not provide very much basics to start from. But I'm having hopes that this may change in the future.
Do historical linguistics, comparative linguistics, have much to say about what was going on that long ago or even more recently?
Well, no, I think the problem is that there was so much movement in the region, culturally, but also ethnologically, ethnically.
So, okay. Well, so that line of thinking is not very helpful, but the iconographic elements are something that obviously is a rather fruitful way of thinking.
The material culture in general. So it's not only iconography, it's
the material culture.
It's stone vessels, it's tool types. We can follow these types so over such a wide region that we really can track down these people and can somehow resurface their communication networks at least. And this is quite a good start.
Let me ask you something about that then. Do the flake stone tools, the flake stone types, continue or are they discontinuous? In other words, you said that there's certain dates that have led you to immediately believe, but do those continue or is there some discontinuity?
Well, they continue and so far they develop into other types, so you can see chronological development.
Yeah, that's very important. That's very significant too. I like that. Very interesting. Yeah. And what was the environment doing about that time? Was there any sort of paleoclimatic episodes that we have to be knowledgeable about that would have affected these people? Mm-hmm.
What we know about the environment back then is that it was probably a bit greener than it is now, but not covered in woods. So it's maybe probably talking about almond and pistachio here. So it's more the scrub kind of trees. So in general, there was not the big event which changed everything. So it does not look like a big climatic impact happened and it was a reason for cultural change as of yet. But again, here we are still at the beginning of this kind of research. And again, I hope that the other sites are providing much more material, plant material, in particular seed material, to help us reconstruct the environment.
What was their main subsistence? What were they eating mainly?
Well, we have a lot of bones, so it's easy to say, we were hunters and we had this aurochs, gazelle and so on. But there's some really groundbreaking research by a colleague of mine, Laura Dietrich, who was analyzing plant processing tools. And she came up with quite a fascinating insight into the variety and the importance of plant food as well. So it's not only the meat-eating hunter. There's a much, much more variation into their diet, actually.
What is she using as her analytical tool to get to the plants?
We have a lot of grinding stones on the sites.
Right.
And she was in a huge project. She was cataloging all these grinding stones. She was looking for micro and macro traces on these stones. And she was recreating experimentally with different kinds of nuts and grains and so on. And was comparing the traces left in these stones and was trying to assess what was actually processed on these stones. And it was quite a fascinating study.
Yeah, that's fabulous.
Yeah, it filled the whole book in the end. So, and it definitely showed us that it's easy to find the bones and the meat, but if you look closer, you find all the smaller traces as well. And definitely plant food played an important part. And it makes sense because this is the time and these are the people who are experimenting with plant food. And this is the step which was pushing them towards food production in the end.
Do you think the site was seasonal or were they there year-round?
It seemed seasonal because the age of the young gazelles hinted at a certain seasonality. But I'm a bit more hesitating now. I'm waiting for the results of these new domestic structures, what they are telling us about how long people are staying at the site. But so far, there seemed to be a strong seasonal focus.
What season of the year were they there?
According to the age of the gazelles, it must have been late spring, early summer, if I'm not mistaken.
Makes sense. So that would make sense in terms of thinking about the seasonal aggregation events, right?
Associated with
the religious ceremonialism that would have attracted people from, you know, larger areas.
Exactly. That was our initial thinking, yeah.
Jen's beautiful. Well, I think we've used up our time, but this has been fabulous, and I so appreciate you sharing. Any last thoughts, Jens?
Well, it definitely was my pleasure, and I'm really grateful that you invited me on the show. And the famous last words probably would be to look at the smaller details and to not underestimate the ingenuity of our ancestors. So there's so much to find and so much to look into.
Thank you so much for the courtesy of your participation. We are honored and blessed.
Thank you.
See you on the flip-flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.